everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
I'm Dawn Keatley.
And today we're talking Black Christmas, the latest adaptation of the 1974 slasher cult favorite, directed by Sophia Takal, whose impassioned defense of the film's PG-13 rating on Twitter launched debate over whether a horror film needs to be rated R to be enjoyable. The film draws explicitly on the Me Too era, but is it effective? We're talking political horror, Joe Bob Briggs, and the importance of audience spectatorship on this episode, so stay tuned. For those who have not seen it, I'm going to give you the official synopsis put out by Universal Pictures. Hawthorne College is quieting down for the holidays. One by one, sorority girls on campus are being killed by an unknown stalker. But the killer is about to discover that this generation's young women aren't willing to become helpless victims as they mount a fight to the finish. So what did everyone think about this latest adaptation of Black Christmas?
It was horrible. I'm just going to tell you. So I went with my girlfriend and her daughter.
Who is how old?
16.
16?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Target audience.
There was probably about 9 people in the theater. And I would say that we were the only 3 that made it through the whole entire film. The people in front of us, as well as the people behind us, ended up leaving.
No way, really?
Oh, 100%. And halfway through the film, our daughter was like, can we just leave? And my girlfriend was like, no, we need to stay because Gwen has to do this for the podcast. So we're going to stay through this. It was like a really, really bad episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That's all I can say.
Are there bad episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
If this was one of them, it would be.
It would be a bad episode.
Yes, yes.
So what you're saying is you didn't enjoy it.
So the 16-year-old daughter ended up spending most of the time on her phone because
wow.
There was nobody she was going to agitate by having her phone on because there was nobody left in the theater afterwards.
Now, the people who left, were they women and men, women?
Men and women, teenagers.
Teenagers,
yes,
really?
100%. They left probably 30, 40 minutes in.
Wow.
Yeah, I have to say when I went, and granted it was 4 o'clock on kind of a snowy day, or it was that day it was supposed to snow. Didn't really. there were only 2 other people in the movie theater. They did stick it out.
We went to a 10:30 showing at night. We were trying
usually
to.
Usually those are full.
Yes, for a horror
teenagers.
Film. And it was a weekend. So
oh my God.
It was a weekend,
wow.
10:30 at night. Like you would think that it was going to be a good showing.
That's really
not
surprising.
So much. Yeah. I think that we had a better time when we got to Sheetz and ate food. And the food wasn't even that good.
Sheetz.
But
sponsor us, Sheetz.
Yes. Hashtag Sheetz. Yeah, I was disappointed, to say the least. Because I didn't know if it was going to be like a remake, if it was going to be like a prequel, a sequel, or whatever. I didn't know. I had no expectations.
Yeah.
Because I've learned this year, if not anything, to go in with low expectations to any horror film.
It's true.
So I still had low expectations, but this was not a remake. It was not. It was something completely different than the original film. And I was definitely disappointed.
I cannot wait to unpack all of that.
Yes, because we'll have to talk about its relation to the 1974 original. And some people have said, why did they bother calling it Black Christmas?
Right.
Who made that choice? Was it Blumhouse? Was it Sophia Takal? And would it have been better as a standalone film? Because whatever expectations you had about it, you had some based on the fact that it was called Black Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, my view is it was kind of a remake. She was redoing it for 2019.
Yeah. But I don't know how effectively. Especially because the original film had so much of that, like, the phone caller into the house kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
And I know
yeah.
that they tried to update it with DMs.
Yeah.
But I really don't think it was effective.
Doesn't translate.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Like, I think that they would have been more effective if they would have kept it, you know, the phone caller calling the phones, like, making those terrible phone calls. The DMs, they were kind of an afterthought for me.
So did you like it?
No, I didn't. But, you know, I have to say, I did not hate it as much as I was expecting to.
Mm-hmm.
I had maybe read a little bit too much about it, or not read stuff necessarily as much as seen headlines. So I had really low expectations.
Yeah.
And I found myself, like, vaguely entertained. Like, I don't think I would have, even though I knew everything that was going to happen, I don't think I would have left, even if I didn't have to stay. And I kind of liked Riley and Chris, the 2 main characters. Riley, played by Imogen Poots, and Chris by Elise Shannon. I had enough interest in those 2 characters to keep me going was about the only thing I thought was good, to be honest.
I think I probably like the movie the best out of the three of
Boo!
Us.
Wait, what?
Well, let me say, I also went to see it with a 16-year-old because I'm old, I'm jaded. I thought, let me go with someone who's the target audience just to make sure that we're on the same page. And her reaction was to be really annoyed by the cliches. And we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But for me, I don't think it's an inherently bad movie, right?
Is.
Well, I was really happy with the casting, right? The casting's a very diverse casting, and I think we need to see more of that in horror. So I was happy with that. And I do think the first scene, the first kill shot before the opening...
With Lindsay?
Right, is aesthetically beautiful. So the cinematography in that moment I liked as well. Having said that, like, as a horror film, I didn't enjoy it because I don't think it's a horror film because the horror was secondary to sort of the political messaging.
Yeah. It was not scary.
Right.
No.
But for me, I found sort of all the passionate opinions about this movie way more interesting than the movie itself.
Yeah.
But I don't hate it. Like, it's fine. I watched it. It's fine. I will say when we went to the theater, ours was a matinee showing, though. So I thought maybe this factored in, but maybe not. There was one other person and then another person entered in and then that one person left. And so it wound up just being the two of us and then this other random person, which was very bizarre and awkward.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It's way better than the first remake.
Do
right?
you think?
From 2006.
I think I might take the jaundicey version of
serious?
The killer over this because we lost all point of view shots.
Yeah.
It became less about the horror within the home.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like a PSA for campus rape culture.
Yes.
Which, again, is important. I'm not going to say it's not.
Right.
And I love some social commentary with my horror, but I felt like I was bashed over the head with it, and there wasn't really any fun, good, scary horror with it.
I guess for me, I feel like the 2006 one was just lazy storytelling, whereas this was a big swing. It was a big miss, but it was also a big swing, and I appreciate that. And like I said, there are elements that I like about it. But I guess the first question we should start with is, since we both saw it with 16-year-olds, do you think this is a film that takes its teen audiences seriously?
No.
No, I don't think so
Not
either.
At all.
That was
Not
my biggest problem with it.
Because she was tuned out before even myself and my girl were.
Yeah.
She was, I think we were probably 30 minutes in, and she was like, can we go? And I don't think that even the idea of college rape on campus was applicable enough to that audience. Like, it might be if you were 19, 20, 21, but still, I don't know if there was enough to really just captivate the audience.
Yeah, like I said, the 16-year-old I went to see it with was very upset by the cliches because she felt like the movie was being written down instead of up. Like, you wouldn't be able to understand any subtext. And I thought that was an interesting point because that was the biggest issue for me is I like political horror a lot, but I like it to be subtextual.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what this is. And she did have a really interesting point, too. At the end, I said, well, you know, how did you feel about the ending? And her response was, well, they're still not going to believe them, meaning like the authorities. Because in the movie, they say, well, you know, you're not going to be believed. That's why they turn back and they sort of pursue the killers, it turns out to be. And she said, well, you know, there might be this group of women saying this happened, but they're still not going to be believed. Like, why didn't that play out in the end? Like, that would have been a stronger way to end rather than where it did. So I thought that was a pretty good observation.
That was the only thing that was consistent with the original film was the kind of the ineffective law enforcement and the ineffective structures, male structures that are in place. But again, I just don't know if it played out well enough because then this whole idea of campus rape culture was undercut by this weird idea of a demonic bust of the college founder.
Bust. Let's get to the most ludicrous part of the film.
Yes, this demonic bust of a college founder that bleeds some black weird stuff.
Yeah.
And that was never really explained.
Like, no.
And even if it was explained, I don't know if it would have been explained enough
for me to
buy into it. Yeah. Like, hey, I know that there were some problems with this guy being the founder of our college. We removed the bust. We kept it in our fraternity house. Some black shit bleeds out of him. And that gives us some satanic powers where we're going to go out and murder and rape people. Like, that is so berserk.
But doesn't it also undercut the film's main message? Because by invoking like the supernatural element, you're taking away some of the agency of the men who are acting this way. And in real life, men act this way without having that supernatural element.
Absolutely. Yeah,
so I hated that part.
I didn't write down the whole epigraph, but I think there was an, you know, like the flashcard that came up at the beginning of the screen, or the card that came up. It was a quote from Calvin Hawthorne, the founder. And I just wrote down part of it. Man possesses such powers, they can only be considered supernatural. Mm-hmm. And I thought, as I thought about it, I thought maybe that sets up the supposedly supernatural powers to be sort of metaphorical of men's power. Because if you see it mm-hmm. as just strictly demonic, supernatural, like this bust is making these men do things they wouldn't normally do, like they're possessed.
Right.
That does take away their agency and their culpability. But if you see that as a metaphor, then, you know, it's sort of emphasizing they have so much power in society to do what they want that it seems supernatural.
The only part that troubles that to me is, well, one, that I don't feel like this is a subtle movie at all.
No.
So even having a metaphor seems like a stretch in that respect. But I think yeah. more so, I can't remember the characters' names because honestly, they were all interchangeable yeah. to me. But the person who wanted to be her boyfriend and was romantically pursuing her.
Landon.
Right?
Yeah.
The way Landon was, because he was going to allow, while he was quote unquote possessed, he was going to allow Riley to be brutalized.
Yeah.
And then only once the bust broke and he was sort of quote unquote freed,
yeah.
did he start fighting with her instead of against her?
But isn't that saying that what that means is that even someone who might seem to be a nice guy is actually a misogynist pig underneath? Because
yeah.
I thought they did that with Marty's boyfriend, too. And his yeah. name I really don't remember. Like, talk about non-entity.
Nate.
Okay.
That's a random note.
I guess he's supposed to be like the perfect 2019 boyfriend in that he just sort of stays in the background, doesn't really offer any opinions, lets the girls do their own thing. But he has that moment in the kitchen where he lashes out at them. And I don't remember exactly what it was all about, but among other things, he accuses Marty of like saying, "You're saying that we're all rapists." I remember him saying that. And she kind of was. But, you know, before he says that, we hear this ringing noise and he clutches his head. I think we're supposed to think he's being demonically affected by the bust. How?
Who knows?
But again, it could be a metaphor for beneath even apparently nice domestic boyfriends, there's the misogynist waiting to come out.
I can buy that. I think what frustrates me about that then is that it's a very specific brand of feminism
this
film is advocating for. And it's really not very intersectional at all.
Yeah.
No.
And that's a problem.
I had real problems with that part of it. Going back to watch the 1974 Black Christmas and even the Scream films, for instance, which I think are similar in what they were trying to do in the 90s. You know, like, there are good men.
Yes, 100%.
You know, there are. But in this film, like, one of the things that got to me was, like, no, there aren't.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, if the demonic possession is working as a metaphor, to me that's even worse because it's saying, like, there are no good men. They're
yeah.
all pigs who want to rape women deep down. So anyway, that was one of the things that I objected to about the movie.
Yeah. I definitely think it's problematic to make it seem as if every man on earth
yeah.
is a horrible person.
Yeah.
Whether he's Every influenced man. By yeah. something or not, like, they're yeah. all bad. That's a huge issue for me.
I mean, in Scream, we had Dewey and Randy and, you know, like, they may not have been the most effectual people in the world. And then in Black Christmas, you know, at the end, Jess kills her boyfriend, Peter, and he's kind of a jerk. But, you know, not entirely. And there's a couple of other not very important, but still not sexist pig men.
Yeah.
Like someone's boyfriend who's trying to find her.
So that sort of brings up, because I, like I said, I'm more interested in the response to this film than the actual film itself. And ground zero, for better or for worse, for a lot of this response is through Twitter.
Yeah.
And I found it very interesting that there seems to be two camps set up, right? There's one camp that this is an awful movie because women hate men, right? Okay. That's very simplistic. That's one camp. The other camp is, no, this is the reality. We need this movie. This is an important movie. Every teenager needs to see this movie. I've seen people.
If you go to college, you're going to get raped, like, or killed? That's ridiculous.
And every man's going to be out to rape you, so.
There seems to not be a lot of space for conversation for feminists who do not like this movie, because the reaction tends to be, well, then you're not a feminist, because clearly this is a movie
you don't like the movie.
If you don't like the movie.
Yeah.
Which is news to me.
Yeah. Like, I can be a feminist without hating men or thinking that they're all going to hurt me or kill me.
And you could even be a feminist and hate Black Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there was anything about this film that was about the original film. I really don't. Because the names are changed. The circumstances have changed. You've lost the point of view shots from the killer. You lost the whole idea of it being a slasher. Like, it was so much less about horror, so much more about college rape culture or whatnot.
Which leads into another question we had, which was, obviously, this is an overtly political horror film. Yeah. It's drawing on the Me Too movement. What do you think about the way the film handles its political messaging? Do you think it's just too much?
Yes. And I love political commentary with my horror.
Yeah.
I do. Like, I love, we were even just recently talking about the Purge television show. I felt like this did it at the expense of the horror.
I agree 100%.
Yeah. I mean, just take the ending for one thing. Like, from, I mean, that was not a horror film ending.
Yeah.
No.
Like, if I remember rightly, like, all the women burst in, all nine of them kill the fraternity guys, burn the house down, and that's it, right?
That was the best part of the film. So my girlfriend leans over to me and she goes, "Are we watching Xena?" And I was like, "No, I'm pretty sure it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the television show," because it was just so weird.
Yeah.
Like, all these women just, and yeah, spoiler alert, all these women just burst onto the scene and start annihilating people.
Yeah.
And it was the weirdest freaking scene I've seen in a horror film in a long time.
And some of these women we'd never seen before. Some of them we saw very fleetingly. It's like, you don't introduce a bunch of characters at the end that we don't know and, like, make them save the day or something. I mean, that was just one problem with it. But it also wasn't a horror movie ending.
No.
I mean, even Get Out, and I do think, like, there were references to Get Out in this film.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it's kind of trying to do the same sort of thing and is sort of a Get Out ripoff, though it does it very badly. Like, just as an aside, the shots of the deer head on the wall, I'm sure you noticed that. There were two long shots of the stuffed deer head on the wall. Like, why? Unless you're just referencing Get Out and saying, look, there's a conspiracy slash cult here, in case you didn't know. But Get Out's ending, and again, I didn't even really think that was kind of a horror ending either. But it was more ambiguous than the ending to this one, in which the women win and all the bad guys are dead. I mean, again, the ending of the 1974 Black Christmas, where Jess kills the wrong guy. And the police have not found the bodies up in the attic. And, you know, we end on the shots of those. And Billy is still talking his insane talk. I mean, that's a horror movie ending.
Yeah. I agree. There was something weird about the nebulous kind of concept of the killers. Like, there was just so many of them.
Yeah.
And how they originated. And
the bust.
Yeah. It was just so weird.
Yeah.
And I think that, because I have such a love for the original horror film, that I would rather this be a completely standalone film that says, I'm a sucky Christmas horror film, rather than just trying to put it into the Black Christmas franchise. Because all of the Black Christmas stuff, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, there was always one killer and you had some backstory and that was completely taken away. And it just made it so much more about this message.
Yeah.
It bashed me over the head with the message, and I don't know. It just kind of really hurt it for me.
It does set up certain expectations that I don't know a PG-13 movie in particular can meet, which I think was a problem. And I definitely saw the connection to Get Out. And I especially like the way the arrival of the police officer is handled in Get Out, because mm-hmm. it's this very sort of shaky moment where you don't know if the police officer is going to believe what just happened. And I feel like that could have been leveraged in this movie really effectively to give a better ending. But I was actually thinking, you know, what other horror movies have we seen that execute this idea of women who've been victimized fighting back and sort of reclaiming their own agency? And I would say, like, The Perfection as well as MFA are two really good, good horror movies where the horror is front-loaded, but you really do get a sense of women fighting back to reclaim their agency against institutional misogyny. This film, I think, really tried it, but
failed
horribly.
Yeah.
Even though there are things that I do enjoy about the movie. Like, if this aired on Lifetime, I would totally sit there with hot chocolate and watch it for 2 hours. But I will never go back and watch it. This will never appear on any of my top horror lists because it's not horror, I don't think.
It was more of a weird supernatural drama.
Well, what do you think? Because you mentioned the Buffy-esque ending, which I think I have to tell you, when you texted me that, I thought, oh my God, that's exactly what that was.
The ending was so campy and weird.
But like, do you think it did anything interesting with the final girl trope, right?
So, I mean, that could be a connection to horror. Anything interesting.
Yeah, no.
And I don't even feel like there was a final girl. Like,
no, because they're ants. And I did like that connection, that you're all connected because you're like ants. You have to defend one each other.
Yeah. I remember in the kitchen early on, they're talking about what their favorite animal is. And I think Marty says an ant because they're all connected and you can't kill them because if you kill one, there's still lots left.
Except
Marty was killed.
And I must have missed that whole entire reference about ants because I'm looking at you like, what?
Well, and it came back again. In case you missed it, it gets mentioned again later on in the film, like to tell you what that metaphor meant.
Yeah.
Like, it means we're all extensions of each other and we can't be killed.
You're not buying that, huh?
No. Mm-mm.
Well, I think in terms of horror elements, the thing I was most frustrated by was that this is a slasher, presumably.
Yeah.
Kill shots are important, right? So
were there any?
No.
We never actually got to see the kill shot. And listen, I get it. I understand that, you know, there's this whole body of scholarship that says, you know, slasher films are inherently misogynistic because of the way the typically female body is dealt with. But there are ways of doing that through a feminist lens. And so it seems strange that a movie that really sort of wallows in this particular brand of feminism wouldn't give us that. And I guess it's to achieve a PG-13 rating.
Yeah.
So my question is, can you have a good PG-13 rated horror movie? And if so, why is this not an example of it? Because I think you can have good PG-13.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, you have Mama, Drag Me to Hell, The Final Girls. I mean, there are a lot of good movies that are PG-13.
The Final Girls was amazing.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I think you can do it, but did this do it? No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. This was just horrible.
But I think, too, like, removing the spectacle does something for the slasher film in particular. Yeah. It was another way of taking the horror out and infusing it with just more messaging.
It almost felt like this film was just trying to right a bunch of wrongs. Yeah. Like, so for example, you know how the cliche is the black guy always dies first.
Yeah.
So it's like it tried to take that and completely reverse that idea. Because you have the one black girl that ends up, you know, making it to the end, kind of leading the fray, you know, so on and so forth. And that, you know, horror films are completely misogynistic. And it tried to undo that unsuccessfully. That the kill shots are probably very much, you know, about penetration. And it tried to undo that, but
we're
unsuccessfully. Like, so I feel like this film was almost like an apology letter to horror films, but it was just a really sad apology letter.
I do hope they put out the unedited version of this because I would love to see how.
Is there one?
Well, because I think they went back and explicitly decided to make this PG-13. I'm sure that they filmed kill shots, and I would love to see what they look like because I think that could be interesting. Like, whether or not they're reflecting that traditional, let's show violence through the expense of women's bodies, or if they're trying to do something different that they just had to cut because of the rating. I would be interested in that. You don't think that they probably did anything interesting.
Mm-mm. And I'm stuck on this weird idea about, like, women's roles. So you have these women that live a liberated life, and they're being punished for it. But then you have that one girl. I can't remember her name. She was, you know, whatever. We thought she was dead, and then she shows up later, and, you know, she's living the subservient traditional family
Helena.
Role.
The traitor to the cause. Yes.
So that she's doing what allegedly is expected of a woman, being subservient, yeah. And then she gets punished too. So mm-hmm. It's kind of like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Like, if you're a woman, you're just F.
Well, I did actually like that. The fact that they had one woman sort of be, quote unquote, the traitor, and showed that even by trying to align yourself with the misogynistic world, you're still expendable. Like, it's not going to protect you, which, of course, made me think about the election and how white women tended to go for Trump.
Correct. I give you that, but what agency...
It was the only part of the film that surprised me when Helena popped back up.
Same. Yeah.
Once I saw she was still alive, I was like, this bitch.
Oh.
You lying sex shit. But, like, I just feel like, so the original film did have very, very much feminist undertones.
Oh, yeah.
But I know that this new one tries to, but, like, what agency really was left for the women?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like,
totally
aside from the fact that they fought back at some point.
Yeah.
But what agency is there? Because it's kind of like you're doomed.
Yeah.
Because if you're a good girl, quote unquote, you're doomed. If you're a bad girl, you're doomed. No matter what, you're doomed, and you're just going to fight and fight and fight and fight and fight, and we don't know if there's going to be an end all for you.
Yeah. Well, and I don't even think the girls who were supposedly liberated had that much agency. I mean, again, looking back at the 1974 Black Christmas, you know, Jess gets pregnant and she, like, says to her boyfriend, I'm not having the baby. I'm having an abortion. And no matter what he says, she's like, nope, sorry, not doing it. There are things I want to do with my life. That's a strong character, someone who has agency. In this film, like, I kind of liked the way what they did with Riley, you know, being a sort of rape survivor. And that does fit in with the slasher, which often focuses on a traumatized character. And I like the fact that, you know, her particular trauma was rape. But I don't know, like... As far as them being liberated, I thought the Santa dance was stupid. I actually found it embarrassing to watch. Like, why are you doing this? Like, why do you have to dress up in sexy Santa costumes and participate in this party just to make this point? You know, at least in the original Black Christmas, they were at a party for underprivileged children. Like, they were just part of a kind of useless culture of a Greek culture.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that really bothered me, and maybe y'all can explain what was going on here, was the Jesse scene. Like, when she looks like she's about to get raped, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, Riley's wandering around the fraternity house and opens a door, and Jesse is in there with some guy, and, you know, she's sort of weakly saying something like, I don't want to, or stop, or something. And Riley has to come in and say, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to leave? And you just get the sense, like, every girl is getting raped.
Yeah.
And, you know, one is okay. Like, Riley is okay. Like, rape is real and it happens. But what was going on with the second scene of a potential rape that Riley stopped?
And it almost diminished the whole idea of rape when you got to the end of the film. Because when you saw that that was the same character that was acting almost as a subservient woman.
No, I think it was a different character.
Was it?
Yeah,
no.
It was
no.
Jess.
No.
I think it was
Jesse
her.
Was the blonde in the beginning that ended up getting killed with the snow angel.
Oh, wait. So that was Helena?
So it was Helena
that
did that. So it almost felt like once I got to the end, I could reflect back on the beginning with that. And I was like, oh, so that was just a plot to kind of reel Riley in or something to that effect.
Okay.
I don't know. It just felt phony and...
That's interesting, because when I saw the scene, I thought it was an authentic attempted rape.
Yeah.
That she was still willing to overlook.
Initially, yes.
Huh.
But by the end, I was
like,
was this
question.
Just part of the plot to
but
get these people
reeling,
that step out of line?
How was it reeling? What was it reeling Riley into exactly?
Building empathy, right?
Because the whole entire film was about finding women that step out of line. And was that just another way to show that she steps out of line? But it really diminished that scene for me by the time I got to the end and saw what Helena was really like.
Well, I have to say, I actually really liked the Christmas singing scene.
Oh.
I actually have it on my work computer, the song.
No.
It was
Mean Girls when they sing that song
in
Mean Girls?
I can't. Well, that's why I like it. I think it's such a cool inversion of the Mean Girls. Because, you know, they're...
still started out with, like, sexy, slutty Santa.
But that's okay. I think it's okay if women want to dress that way and present themselves that way. They should have the, you know, autonomy to do that. And I think I like the way that it sort of, on the surface, reflects all of those scenes where it's just about spectatorship, right? And then incorporating the lyrics to try to undermine that. I don't think it's effective particularly, but I do think, again, these are like big swings. And you have to appreciate a big swing, right?
No. And big misses.
I'd rather see a movie try something and fail than just give us the same regurgitated stuff over and over again.
Well, I guess, too, I think that it's problematic for me that the whole entire thing was set in the Greek culture. Because then that also really pigeonholes the message. Like, this only happens in Greek culture.
Oh, okay.
And let's be honest, too, that it's not always in the Greek culture. Like, is there, you know, lots of drinking? Is there hazing? Is there all kinds of all that other stuff that happens? Yes. But, you know, a lot of this can happen to people that aren't in that lifestyle. And I think that people might feel alienated by that because it was so set in that, without any exception, that was hard for me to swallow, too.
Mm. Yeah. It was definitely a much more enclosed world than the Black Christmas world, the 1974 world.
And I struggled with the fact, too, that it was just so much outside of the house. I struggled with that because the original film was so much about inside the house.
Yeah.
And how you're never really safe, even when you think you are. And I'm also going to be honest. I was really missing her.
Barb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought that the one character from this film was going to be similar to her.
Right.
She talked about, you know, not wanting to go home and her parents are going to go off to the ski trip.
Yeah.
And, you know, blase, blase. But I was like, I was really missing that really liberated character of Barb. No matter how drunk she was, I didn't ever really get a sense that anybody in the film was super liberated.
Yeah.
I feel like that was supposed to be Chris, right?
I totally agree with that. That there was Barb and Jess, who in 1974 were just like liberated, like fuck you and everything else. And Chris is that kind of character. But it's like 2019.
There's nobody unapologetic.
Yeah.
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 And I have a problem with that.
I think it's the way she was presented as unapologetic, right? Because she's like, this is the way you act as a woman. And in the end, Riley agrees with her, saying, yes, I should have been fighting back the entire time.
Yeah.
That I didn't like, because for a trauma survivor, no, you don't always have to fight back. Sometimes just doing self-care and making sure you're okay is enough, which is what Riley was doing. It just didn't fit what the women around her thought she should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was a problem for me.
Well, the difference between Chris in 2019, though, and she was definitely the most like overtly sort of outspoken, in-your-face character. I mean, obviously, Riley was struggling with trauma, and then the other characters did not seem to have personalities. Chris's liberatory power comes entirely from her politics. Like, you know, and she has a political line. She's towing it, and she wants everyone else to. And I guess in 1974, though, you know, Barb was just like completely inappropriate, you know, like saying mean things about underprivileged children. I mean, that's why it was more of a horror film. Like, she was just like against any kind of status quo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chris's character is for a particular kind of status quo, a particular kind of feminism, which is quite strong on college campuses. It's not like there's no one out there saying those kinds of things, right?
That's a really good point. I didn't think of that. You're right, because the original movie, she's trespassing against everything.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie only trespasses against things that it knows that a targeted audience are going to agree with.
But it was so weird. Like, I start, like, when I was watching the film, I started to think about, like, you know, when I grew up in the 80s and the 90s and so on and so forth, like how feminism became such a dirty word.
Yeah.
Because feminism became aligned with these man haters and these combat boot wearers. And there was just something about this film that took me back to those times, that it felt like this brand of feminism was really alienating. And that if you were somebody that was fully about, you know, female empowerment, you could potentially watch this film, see some of the characters that are supposed to be indicative of feminism, and be like, wow, that doesn't represent me, and I'm not a part of that, and really feel alienated. So there was just something about this film and the characters that felt exclusive.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I kind of liked Chris as a character, she was definitely a one-note character.
Yeah.
Like, virtually everything out of her mouth was some version of fight the white supremacist patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, couldn't there be a bit more to her character than that?
Yeah.
You know,
because
it does set her up as like, all she is embodying a particular kind of feminism, and that risks alienating people.
And honestly, where were the lesbians? Because you're not going to tell me in a sorority house there's not going to be one lesbian. There wasn't. So
what are you talking
for a
about?
Film,
I don't understand what you're talking about. I did happen to be in a sorority. I'm Sigma Sigma Sigma.
No, but I was not in a sorority. But my point being more, you know, for a film that's so concerned on the surface about feminism, there really was no space made for any coupling or identity that wasn't heteronormative in this movie.
It's true. Like, Marty had a boyfriend. Riley was clearly straight because I guess she was on a date with the person that raped her. Do we know anything? Well, maybe Chris. We don't know anything about her.
But then is that problematic? If like, so let's just let's just kind of, you know, problematize that. If Chris would be the lesbian and then she's the one causing all the trouble and she's the one that's saying that all men are bad.
Right.
Is that an issue?
A man-hating lesbian.
Yeah.
Yes,
of
right?
course
Never
that would
that
be
that
an
before.
Issue. Yeah. Of course that would be an issue. But I mean, even just making Marty, who, you know, has the boyfriend, maybe saying she's bisexual or at least creating some sort of space for something that isn't heteronormative. And there was no space given to that at all. For a movie like this, I think is an oversight.
Yeah.
That's a part of its kind of simplistic politics.
Yeah.
You know, like it is about sort of evil men versus, honestly, quite for the most part, sort of victimized, clearly mostly heterosexual women.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give credit where credit's due because the original film was very much about these feminist undertones and really having a female narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this current film tried to keep some of that female narrative, but it was just so freaking unsuccessful.
I just like how angry you are about this movie.
Oh, I just felt so bad for like my girl's daughter too, just sitting there like, wow, this is dumb.
She's like, Gwen's the worst. She took me to this awful movie.
Like, can't we just leave now?
Oh gosh, that's not good. But I think all of this does bring us to the Joe Bob Briggs issue, which I did want to talk about because I found this fascinating. So over the Thanksgiving holiday week, Twitter blew up when Joe Bob Briggs, who is pretty much, I think it's fair to say at this point, a horror institution, and is a character created by John Irving Bloom, who hosts The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs on Shudder. He tweeted the following, quote, "What I love about directors from the 70s and 80s is that they had no political axe to grind, no message, no social justification for horror. It was just get a load of this great story. I don't want to be told how to watch a movie," end quote. So Twitter did what Twitter does best, and people started losing their minds. Some people very correctly pointed out the political history of horror in these decades.
Which he should
especially
know.
In the 70s.
Yeah.
While others defaulted to name-calling, right, because it's Twitter. Briggs then clarified what he meant was that he prefers the political messaging in his horror films to be subtextual. So he did an interview with Patrick Kavanaugh of Comic Book, and Briggs was asked about the controversy, and he said, again, quote, "I wasn't trying to open up a discourse. Actually, when I wrote that, I was watching Chopping Mall, and I was thinking, we don't really have chopping malls anymore. We have very serious horror movies. We don't have these extremely lighthearted movies anymore. I've never asked writer-director Jim Wynorski if he had a political subtext to Chopping Mall, but I don't think he does. I would almost wager that he does not," end quote. Now, listen, I can find a political message in any movie. Probably
including
I could
Chopping
find
Mall?
One in Chopping Malls.
Sure, it's about malls.
That's right.
There
you go.
There's got to be some sort of
consumerism.
Message about malls.
But does he have a point? Because in thinking about Black Christmas, would it have been a better movie if the horror was more subtextual
100%.
Instead of being overt?
100%. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because in a horror film, I mean, if you're going to call a genre horror, it's got to be horrific. And I think that the horror, the blood, the gore, the scare, the, you know, abject needs to be number one. And then underneath that, you can still have your subtext.
And that there needs to be something shocking about it. I mean, it was clear from the beginning who the bad guys were.
Oh,
I mean, you can cater to a female audience like, for instance, the Scream films did, and like I think Black Christmas from 1974 does. But you don't have to be, like, utterly predictable. No. And what made the film predictable was its politics.
Yeah.
Honestly, the politics were driving the plot, so you knew the fraternity were the bad guys.
Yeah. And my girl the whole entire time is like, the professor's involved, the fraternity's involved.
Although,
and like,
let's
so
give
on and
credit
so forth.
Where credit's due. The casting of the professor and having the romantic lead from the Princess Bride be the evil guy. I was like, okay, that was smart.
Yes.
So we have to give some
love
like to
him because he's been in great films. However, but she's like, he's involved and they're involved. And I was like,
was
well,
obvious.
Maybe they're really just trying to throw us off. I was like, so maybe they're making it so freaking obvious that it'll throw us off and there's going to be a twist. No twist.
No twist.
That was the twist, was that there was no twist.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like with Get Out, for instance, to go back to that again, I actually was genuinely surprised when Rose, the girlfriend, turns out to be evil, too. Mm. You know, like, there was surprises for me in that film. It wasn't completely predictable. This was completely predictable. And I didn't watch the trailer, but apparently the trailer gave it all away anyway
for some reason.
Yeah. Well, when I went back and looked at the trailer, I was amazed. It really gives the entire movie, including the twist about the one girl being in cahoots with the men.
That was the only thing that shocked me.
I guess everybody should watch the trailer because it gives away all the spoilers. You won't be mad at us. And
it's all in the trailer.
That's junk.
I mean, that shows that all that matters is the politic. Like, come to see this because it's a Me Too Black Christmas. Don't expect to be surprised by anything. The battle lines are drawn. It's all women versus, except for Helena, versus all men. I wanted to know what you thought about this, actually, because it's something that's been happening in a lot of movies recently. And we talked about it with Spiral. You know, when the entire community in that town is sort of like a cult, you know, killing people who are different, who are other. It seems like there's a shift now where the kind of monsters of horror aren't sort of pathological, psychotic individuals anymore. It's groups of kind of, quote, normal people. In fact, the more, normal you are, the more likely you are to be, like, the monster or the killer. I mean, Get Out was obviously did that. Because, you know, look at Black Christmas. It was like some sick individual who was doing the killing and all of the slashers from the 80s. But now it's a, quote, normal group. Like, what do you think about that as a trait of a horror movie?
I mean, it feels like it makes sense to me because if horror is a reflection of our political times, which I think it is, we definitely are living in a time when people are in their silos. Things are divided. It's very much an us against them mentality that you see reflected everywhere, politically, socially.
So the monsters are groups that are different from you.
I think they have to be because it seems like a lot of individual accountability has been erased in a lot of ways culturally. And now it's just everything's the mistake of the group or affiliation.
See, but I feel like it still diffuses the horror when you put it into a group. And I feel like, okay, yes, sometimes people will act in a certain way when they're in a group because you have that whole idea of, like, you know, groupthink and whatnot. And yes, there are still, you know, problematic groups, but they don't typically enact this type of horror. Like, I think it's smaller individuals that tend to enact these horrible types of things. Like, so, you know, even if you want to make it overtly political and say, okay, you have people that might be, you know, super, you know, Trump voters, okay, just to kind of create a group. That 30%. Because, you know, you have the impeachment stuff going on and so on and so forth. But that 30% of people that, you know, act in a certain type of way, do I still fear them? No. Do I think that they're going to kill me, rape me, be horrible freaking people? No. Do I think that they have completely different views than me that are absurd? Yes, I might feel that way, but do I think that they're unredeemable? No.
What if it was a cult of Southern people?
I don't know if I would hang out with them in Appalachia.
I
actually think you're really onto something there because I think most people would answer that differently.
Really?
Like, I think that is the point of horror now. It is like people don't think Trump voters are just people who have different political views from me. They voted for a different candidate. You know, all well and good. They don't even think maybe I can't even talk to that person. They think that they are evil. You know, like there's this polarity now.
Yeah,
like,
there
where
is.
People just think the other group is capable of anything. But so I think you're the rare person who thinks you could probably still talk to a Trump
This voter. Is the first time that I think that I might ever be accused of being the optimistic person in any room. But I guess what it is, too, is like, you know what? My best friend on this earth, whom I've loved and cared about deeply, profoundly for, you know, 20, 25 years, is a Trump voter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we have zero problems whatsoever. And I guess I think to lump her in to this idea that groups of people,
yeah,
just because of what they think and believe are horrible, I don't know. And, you know, even too, like, you know, I do get angry about the whole idea of, like, suburban white women who have, you know, kind of turned their back and you know, put this person in office and whatnot. As individuals, I don't think that they're bad people at all. I don't. I feel like people are people. Individuals are individuals. They're redeemable. And I think that to lump anything into a group, just like this film did, is not okay.
I feel like we're having such a Freaky Friday moment because I would love to say I agree with you.
It's okay if you don't.
And well, philosophically, I want to agree with you because I know plenty of people who are Trump voters.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, you know, I think there was the Trump voter at the time of the election, and then there's the people who still support Trump now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that they're necessarily the same people.
Let's
because
find out.
Supporting, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, supporting Trump now means being okay with, you know, children being in cages or transphobia, you know, the legislation that's been enacted. This isn't a disagreement on, like, economic issues. This is a disagreement on, like, who counts as people and who we value in society. I have found it, personally, much more difficult to deal with those people in my life and still remember, okay, I still love you.
But you do.
I do. I would never turn my back on them.
But I struggle with it because, like, I know you have military people in your family background,
yeah,
as do I. I mean, my grandfather was a colonel. And, like, you know, from his philosophy was, no matter what, the commander-in-chief is your commander-in-chief. You have to respect him. And even, too, when I think about my best friend, you know, she voted for him in, you know, the original election. She
yeah.
would still be pro-Trump right now. But she's also a military family, too, that says your commander-in-chief is your commander-in-chief. And I can't fault somebody for some of those values. Just because they're not necessarily mine, I can't. And so same thing when I bring it back to the film, I can't say that every single fraternity boy suffers from this groupthink, can't think for himself, because I'm not going to take away the agency of men that live in a fraternity house because they wanted to have some type of a brotherhood, to have some type of a network, to have some type of alumni, you know, connection, and say that they're just mindless idiots. Like, I can't do it. Like, for as much as I like to joke about stupid stuff with, you know, frat houses and sorority houses, I can't do it. And I think that that's what this film does, is at the expense of male agency, they tried to make a female-centered film. And it's not okay, because all you're doing is flipping the narrative in a different way. Because before it used to be like, let's do everything at the expense of women. Well, it's not okay to just flip it.
It's still marginalizing.
You have to update it. Yeah, you're completely doing that. And yes, I understand that, you know, middle class, upper class, white males have a certain amount of power that other people don't, that they're afraid to lose, or, you know, they have certain privilege. But again, it's not okay to just pigeonhole people, period, ever. Take that.
There are disagreements that can be had, but some things are lines in the sand, right? If I say to you, I don't consider you a person,
mm-hmm.
and I don't believe you should be protected legally, that's a different conversation than saying we have different views on how to create infrastructure within the country. We're talking about, like, seminal values of who counts as people. And so I do understand what the movie's trying to get at in terms of saying that there does feel like there's this collective whole that's creating a cultural shift. It's this notion that it's not just a person, it's this group. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is interesting, like, the cult angle, because typically, at least historically, cults tend to turn their anger on themselves. So you have, like, the Branch Davidians, you see, like, mass suicides, you don't necessarily see mass violence
mm-hmm.
outward.
I don't know. Like, it was just such a flaccid film for me.
Yeah, I mean, it constructs, I think, so much of what we've said, just get it, how it constructs two collectivities.
Yeah.
I mean, the fraternity with the professor, the cult, they all think exactly the same. And any guy who gets even in the vicinity, no matter who he was beforehand, he starts thinking the same as mm-hmm. they do. And then the women, too. You know, like what you said, you objected to Riley saying at the end, I should have been fighting all along. There's only one space for women in this film. And even if you're traumatized and a survivor, you know, like, you have to be as, or you should have been a certain way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's just these two collective subject positions and nothing else. I have to say, if you're out there and you haven't seen Sophia Takal's first horror movie, you should. It was one of the Into the Dark series on Hulu, which is being run by Blumhouse, who produced Black Christmas 2. But she directed one that came out last December called New Year, New You. And it's a horror film that actually centers on four women. And it's the complete opposite of everything we've been saying about Black Christmas. I mean, I think it's a better film. It's not a great film, but it's better than Black Christmas. But it's about four women who are all very different, who have the space to take completely different positions. And it centers on a main female character who is just, like, brilliantly evil. There's trauma in the film, too.
It's a little like it.
Yes!
It's just everything that horrible. This is not. So if... You know, I think Sophia Takal, actually, for as much as I did not like this film, she definitely has a future as a director of horror. And I think New Year, New You is a really good example of what she can do.
So if I am going to get stereotypical, though.
Oh, dear.
So as, like, a lesbian who loves cats.
The cat!
I felt like the cat in this remake really lost a lot of agency, too.
Although, did you know... I know we didn't stay to the end of the credits, but did either one of you stay to the end of the credits?
No. Something happen?
With the cat. So the cat apparently comes back on screen and starts licking at the black goo.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
I saw that.
Okay, now it's, now it's totally a bad film. Now they will rise up and take their rightful place. Taking everything.
That's actually really interesting, I have to say.
Now cats are bad? No, cats can't be bad.
This explains the Cats movie, though.
Yeah. The remake? Oh, I'm so upset about that.
I don't know much about cats, but it's the same kind. It's the same cat that was in the 74 film, right? Like a white, fluffy one?
I think the original retired.
Yeah.
Well, no.
But like the same breed? I don't think so. This one looks like a Turkish fan. I don't know if the first one did.
Resist. Well, they were similar. They were fluffy and white. I don't know all my cat breeds.
But you're talking to cat ladies.
Did she just like shame me there?
I mean, you actually know what kind of cat it is. I'm very impressed.
Impressed in air quotes.
It was white. The fourth film ends with the cat, if I remember rightly, like sniffing around one of the dead bodies in the attic.
Well, it licks the plastic on the one where she's on, which is such a great scene.
Yeah.
I wish this movie had those scenes.
No, it had none. Like, even when I saw the dress in the plastic, I was like, oh, somebody's going to get choked by the plastic.
Yeah, I thought
somebody's
going to
get choked by the plastic. Yeah. Like, so uneventful.
Yeah.
Although, still, I liked the snow angel scene. I thought that was very pretty.
Yeah.
I thought
that was good.
And that was the most graphically violent scene, too, I think. Because he stabs her with an ice. You don't really see it exactly.
No. But it's also not pragmatic. Because my girlfriend said the same thing. She was like, oh, that's beautiful. It almost looked, you know, from an angel to a Jesus kind of thing.
Yeah.
But no, you would have to fold her arms in to drag her. Because if you didn't fold her arms in to drag her, it wouldn't give you the same outline in the snow. It's not pragmatic, right?
Well, when it snows, we will reenact it. And we will see how accurate it was. I mean, we won't really kill you, but we'll drag you.
Why is it gotta be me that gets dragged?
I'll save the cat.
Asshole.
So anything else left to say on this particular Black Christmas?
Like, look, if you're drunk and bored at home and you have Fire Stick, do it.
Although I guess the movie's not doing very well, which makes sense since none of us saw it in a crowded theater at all.
No. I think max, I had 9.
And we were all around opening weekend, weren't we?
Yeah.
Well, let us know what you think about Black Christmas. We're very excited to hear differing opinions.
Yes.
You can find us on all social media at Horror Homeroom. And I've never said this before, but I hear other podcasts say this. Rate and review us on iTunes. I'm 90% sure we're there. So... next time we will maybe do Ready or Not.
I'm down
for
whatever.
Might be the movie to do. All right. In the meantime, happy holidays, and we will talk to you later.
Bye.